ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, a tourism temperature check. Some are busy, but not all accommodation providers have had a happy Easter. Turnover's down by 40% in some areas. An appeal for the government to reconsider plans to fast-track the approval process for major gas project development, and sharks on the move as climate change causes ocean temperatures to rise.
We are starting to see tiger sharks and bull sharks moving further south, possibly down as far as the far western parts of Victoria, and this can shift ecosystem dynamics or how the ocean works.
Thanks for your company this Easter Monday. If you've been lucky enough to get away for a break this long weekend, you may be starting to suffer the back-to-work blues. As you pack up the car or head to the airport this evening, you may already be stuck in a traffic jam trying to get home. But no doubt tourism operators will have been very pleased to see you as they try to bounce back from bad weather in recent months, the longer-term downturn triggered by COVID, and of course, the cost of living crunch. Samantha Donovan has been taking a look at how our tourism industry is faring.
In Western Australia, Susan Irving runs a nature park with accommodation by the Margaret River. This Easter long weekend, her place is fully booked.
Still had a lot of people that obviously are still down this way trying to get in as well, but because we're at full capacity, we can't take any more. We're already full. It's sunny and they're all happy and it's busy.
Craig Wickham runs a touring company on Kangaroo Island in South Australia.
My Easter has been busy. We've got lots of guests. Our international travellers are back exploring. We've seen koalas out in the bush, kangaroos, wallabies, about to go and see some long-nosed fur seals, had a picnic in the bush, lovely mild conditions, a little bit of rain, which was perfect because it meant all the roos come out to have a drink.
Craig Wickham's Easter bookings have bounced back to their pre-COVID levels, as was the case last year.
Our market mix is probably quite similar in that we're back to 90% internationals and 10% domestic, so that's really pretty much where we were pre-pandemic.
In Port Douglas, Steve Edmondson is celebrating 21 years offering sailing tours of the Great Barrier Reef, but it's been a difficult start to the year after flooding and cyclones hit the region.
So it's a sort of a sluggish, slow start, a softer Easter, but I'm really seeing positive signs in the last couple of days. You know, when you hear and you get negative news, you think it must be, we love Port Douglas, but we'll go later. So it takes people a while just to get used to, are you really open and everything's good? And yeah.
But not all tourism businesses are having a bumper Easter. Brett Farnan offers whitewater rafting tours on the Franklin River in Tasmania.
We're probably down a little bit on numbers this year. We normally have a full trip and we've got a trip with six people on it where it could have 12 on it, I guess. Every other year it's been full. We sort of put it down to, post-COVID, people going overseas, the economic environment and just a little bit of people being unsure about things, I guess.
Evan Hall from the West Australian Tourism Council is thrilled most of the state's operators have been fully booked this Easter, but he says that won't last long.
The main concern for the industry is what happens after the school holidays are over and all the local residents are back at work and back at school. And that's when we really need particularly the international visitors to come in. And we're still well behind on those international visitors.
Daniel Geschwind is a professor at Griffith University's Institute for Tourism and a former chief executive of Queensland's Tourism Industry Council. He says after COVID lockdowns and travel restrictions, many Australians are now opting for trips overseas to spots like Bali, Fiji and Thailand. But trips at home are still popular for short breaks like Easter.
We can also take for granted that Australians have developed a perhaps more sophisticated understanding of the Australian product and the destinations that they previously, pre-COVID, may not have considered. So some of the smaller regions, regional destinations in Australia, are doing relatively well in the domestic market again, and that's good to see.
Which spots are you talking about there?
Well, within Queensland, for instance, you know, southern Queensland country, Mackay, even Brisbane, some of the city destinations around Australia, and some of the closer drive tourism destinations to capital cities have done quite well during COVID. And some of that reputation and understanding is now continuing in the domestic travel market. And that's good to see.
In terms of traveller numbers, how are they comparing at the moment to before the pandemic?
Well, we're getting closer to pre-pandemic levels, that's for sure. We see international inbound numbers recovering, still not quite at the level of pre-COVID, but still recovering nevertheless. Domestic travel has enjoyed very strong numbers in those days that didn't have complete lockdowns. The domestic numbers during COVID looked actually quite good, but now Australia-wide, the domestic holiday numbers are on the increase. We still have some way to go to reach some of the peaks, and we're hoping this Easter will deliver a bit of a bonus to many destinations across Australia. We have to bear in mind that we've had a fairly mixed summer. The weather, not just in North Queensland, but across all states of Australia, has really thrown a few curveballs, which has impacted on travel and expenditure patterns. And we hope that gradually those weather patterns are settling down. And Easter, again, was a slightly mixed bag, but nevertheless is hopefully delivering a fairly big bonus to tourism operators across the country.
Easter is early this year and only three states are on school holidays. So how does that affect tourism operators?
Well, it certainly spreads it out a bit. That's a good thing that we have holidays in all, not all states coinciding. So that's good news for tourism operators. And as the weather improves and as the rain diminishes a bit, it hopefully will see many people doing last minute bookings and getting on those planes or in their car and enjoying what's left of the late summer.
That's tourism expert Daniel Geschwind from Griffith University. That report by Samantha Donovan and Alison Shaw. Leaders from the Northern Territory's remote Tiwi Islands are appealing to the federal government to reconsider its determination to pass laws aimed at accelerating the process of approving or not major offshore gas developments. Faster yeses and noes is how the Treasurer put it. The government moved the changes after gas companies complained. Court actions challenging project approvals are costing too much and threatening international investment. Here's Jane Barton.
Indigenous elder Maralampui Kurupu is among Tiwi people opposing Santos's Timor Sea Barossa $5 billion gas field and its pipeline that will pass the remote islands en route to Darwin.
It might affect our environment, you know, such as seafood, turtle eggs, fish, everything that we is edible.
He feels the Tiwi people haven't had enough say over the project.
The process is going ahead without more consultation with the clan. It's really affecting them, and the Tigalado clan group are not happy.
Tiwi opponents succeeded in delaying it by 16 months, adding $450 million in costs by proving in the federal court that Santos hadn't carried out enough Indigenous consultation. But last week, the federal government gave environmental approval for the pipeline construction to go ahead. Maralampui Kurupu is now worried changes the federal government is planning to make to its laws for approving offshore gas projects could allow the resources minister to reduce the requirement for traditional owner consultation on these developments.
We're not getting support from government, you know, in a small remote community. Not only Tiwi, but there's other remote community.
Tiwi Islander Antonia Burke, who's leading the opposition to the Barossa project, is also worried.
If they go ahead and make changes to this legislation, then they can go ahead and fast-track all of the environmental approvals for all of these offshore mining projects.
The offshore gas amendments would give the Resources Minister more power to change the rules under which the regulator approves projects, including rules on consultation. The amendments also extend a special exemption for the gas industry so offshore projects don't have to be assessed under federal environment laws. Antonia Burke's concerns haven't been reduced by tweaks the government has recently made to give the Environment Minister input into the Resources Minister's decisions.
We do not feel reassured by the Environment Minister having a little bit of a say in what's happening to the environment. That is her sole responsibility.
Both Indigenous leaders and the gas industry gave their views to a parliamentary committee considering the laws last month. Sandra McCulloch heads the gas industry's peak body, Australian Energy Producers.
What the industry is now seeking is clarity and certainty around the offshore approvals framework and in particular consultation requirements. It's clear that the ambiguity and uncertainty is leading to significant delays. It's leading to significant expense for the industry.
Santos General Counsel Michael Abbott told the committee requirements on gas companies to consult Indigenous groups are being used to stop projects.
The consultation process has to give the opportunity for people to be heard, but it has to have some limits around the timeframes that we're involved with in it.
The government is struggling to get support to pass the laws from the crossbench and the Greens in the Senate and may have to rely on the coalition to pass them. Greens Resources spokeswoman Senator Dorinda Cox.
Why is the minister not listening? And why are we taking the element of protection for the environment, for First Nations people and communities away from the minister who's responsible for them?
The Resources Minister, Madeleine King, says the laws aren't intended to weaken consultation requirements or environmental protections.
The main thing I want to achieve is greater clarification around consultation, but there's no power grabs of any sort whatsoever. That is just made up.
Tiwi elder Marilyn Pui Kurupu says he's worried if more quickly approved gas projects add to greenhouse emissions, communities like his will feel it first.
The temperature before was okay, but now it's building up. The sea rise, it goes right up, and the climate change, it's really affecting us. The government need to listen to us, you know?
That's Marilyn Pui Kurupu, a Tiwi elder, speaking to our reporter Jane Barden. Russia is intensifying its assault on Ukraine, significantly stepping up its campaign against Ukraine's energy facilities. The significant damage left over a million Ukrainians without power and has many in fear of a return to rolling blackouts like those seen in the first winter of the war. As momentum continues to swing behind Russia, it's now demanding Ukraine extradite a group of people connected with what it calls acts of terrorism, including Ukraine's head of security. Rima Chia reports.
At the St. Nicholas Cathedral in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, pilgrims mark the third Easter Vigil since the Russian invasion. It's the most important day on the Catholic calendar. And for Lyudmila Mikhailishina, it's her first Easter back in the city since she fled the war in 2022.
The only dream I have for everyone is to restore peace and justice. I wish that Ukraine would defeat its inner enemies as well as its outer enemies.
Vadim Vyalko says dwindling international support has cast a pall over the holiday.
We feel that Ukraine is becoming exhausted. It's hard for us. Our hope is that Europe and the whole world will help us, including the Christian world. I ask everyone to pray.
Russia's defense ministry says it's conducted a concentrated campaign in recent days, launching several missile strikes on Kyiv and targeting Ukrainian energy facilities. More than a million people across Ukraine are without power, and this man lined up with hundreds of others in Kharkiv to get much-needed fuel.
It's for the generator, to at least be able to get some water with the pump. Also, to have power to keep running my business, to continue working somehow.
The National Energy Operator says the shelling has forced emergency shutdowns in the city of Odessa near the Black Sea. And the largest private energy provider says 5 out of its 6 plants have been significantly damaged, cutting 80% of its capacity, and it'll take 18 months to repair. The shelling has also killed at least 5 people in the Kharkiv, Donetsk and Lviv regions in the east. Russia says it was targeting sites where weapons and ammunition were being manufactured. The strikes drew anger from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Russian terrorists are now targeting us with such vile strikes to cause the energy bleeding of Ukraine. America, Europe, our other partners, Everyone knows what we need. Everyone knows how important it is right now to help us protect ourselves from these blows at this very moment.
It's raising fears that the war is escalating even further as the fallout from the mass shooting at Crocus Hall in Moscow continues. More than 140 people were killed in the attack. Islamic State has claimed responsibility, and US officials say they have evidence showing it was carried out by the network's Afghan branch, ISIS-K. But Russian investigators claim they have proof that the concert hall gunmen were linked to Ukrainian nationalists. And the Kremlin is demanding Ukraine hand over all people connected with terrorist acts committed in Russia since 2022. That includes the head of Ukraine's intelligence agency, or SBU. Ukraine says it's a pointless request and hypocritical given that Russian President Vladimir Putin was subject to an international arrest warrant. Meanwhile, NATO celebrates its 75th anniversary this week. The Transatlantic Defence Alliance was launched when US President Harry Truman signed it in 1949.
To maintain friendly relations and economic cooperation with one another, to consult together whenever the territory or independence of any of them is threatened, and to come to the aid of any one of them who may be attacked. If there is anything certain today, it is the will of the people of the world for freedom and for peace.
As the current crisis rolls on, President Zelensky is urging Western allies to provide it with additional air defense and ammunition.
That report from Rima Chia. You are listening to PM with me, David Lipson. Don't forget, you can, on the ABC Listen app, hear all of our programs live or later. Well, most of us will be back to work tomorrow, but Federal Parliament is now on a break until mid-May when the budget is handed down. Over the next 6 weeks, the Treasurer and his economic team have a lot to think about, primarily how to deliver a budget that offers some cost of living relief in the lead-up to an election without adding to inflation. Income tax cuts will begin in July, and the government's also urging Fair Work Australia not to allow wages to go backwards when it sets the minimum wage. So can all of this be achieved without putting too much heat into the economy and delaying interest rate cuts? Political reporter Tom Crowley covered this ground in a piece for ABC News Online. Tom, the Treasurer is again urging for wages not to go backwards, but at the same time he's hoping interest rates will come down. Can he have both?
Well, he's certainly entitled to hope so, David. I think it's fair to say. Look, the Treasurer doesn't obviously control the levers for either wages or interest rates. But what he did last week was let the Fair Work Commission know that he didn't want to see workers get a real pay cut. So the Fair Work Commission, ahead of July, will make its annual decision on what should happen to minimum and award wages. That covers the wages of about one in five Australian workers. It's a pretty significant decision. It is significant for the government to say that we think the wage rise should match inflation. That would be a pretty significant increase, just as it was last year. At least at the moment, though, I think the outside running is, I think it's unlikely that a significant wage rise would significantly derail the inflation fight. And that's because things are going pretty well at the moment. You know, at least in the words of the RBA Governor Michelle Bullock, wages haven't been a problem so far. But there is some risk that if wages continue to rise in an elevated way, the RBA might get a little nervous and might start to delay its decision about a rate cut.
For a long time, the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, has been talking about walking this narrow path. And he's now pointing out that, yes, wages are growing, have been for some time. Inflation is moderating, has been for some time. And as you mentioned, the unemployment rate actually fell unexpectedly last month. Can he keep this political trifecta, as you term it in your piece, going, or will something give eventually?
As far as charting a course out of that, you know, that stormy weather, the RBA set a course about 2 years ago that said, all right, let's try and get inflation back down to a normal level by the end of 2025. And let's see if we can do that while keeping unemployment to about 4.5%. That's that sort of narrow path that both the Treasurer and the RBA talk about. And so far we're on it. I mean, last week we got the quite extraordinary news, really, that unemployment was 3.7%. I mean, these numbers, people can get a bit lost in them, but 3.7% is a very low number. It's lower than the month before. It's a sign that even as inflation is falling, and we got further confirmation of that last week as well, so far things are looking good. But you know, the last mile's always difficult.
So it's April now. We've got a budget in May. What do you think the budget will tell us about how optimistic or perhaps pessimistic the government feels right now about the economy?
Well, I guess the first thing to remember, David, is that this is a pre-election budget. It might be the last budget that Labor gets before it goes to the next election. And as we know, pre-election budgets, there is always a temptation for governments to spend plenty, to have some nice goodies, I suppose, for want of a better word, that they can take to the electorate. That, in the context of the macroeconomic picture, I think that'll be the real test of exactly how the government sees these things. I think if the government is genuinely quite convinced that we are on this narrow path, if the government's ready to declare victory over inflation, essentially, we might see that it is willing to spend a fair bit of money, particularly in the second, third and fourth years of the budget window, the forward estimates, and it might not feel that it needs to hold its purse strings quite as tight as it has sought to so far in this term of government. On the other hand, if it's still a little bit worried about, you know, winds buffeting us off this path to a narrow landing, then we might see a more cautious approach. But it's far too early to tell. I think that overall big picture, you know, how much is the government spending in each year of its budget? That, to me, will be the real tell of how confident it is that we're nearly out of this cost of living crisis and moving back to perhaps more business as usual, both for the economy and the budget.
A month and a half or so to wait until then. Tom Crowley, thanks for that.
Thanks, David.
Tom Crowley there, and you can find his analysis on the ABC News website. Well, despite all the focus on domestic violence in recent years and all the money that's been thrown at the problem, far too many women are still being turned away from crisis accommodation. Some go back to violent partners, others end up on the streets. In Hobart, a plan to reopen a supported accommodation complex hinges on government support, but no commitment's been made and the lengthy Tasmanian state election process is delaying action. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Turning to a women's shelter is often a last resort when fleeing domestic violence or a dangerous situation. But women who call Hobart's women's shelter for assistance are almost certain to be turned away. Janet Saunders is the shelter's chief executive.
For many women contacting a women's shelter, you know, they think that they'll be able to come in and get the support that they need, but unfortunately it's just not the case. For the first quarter of this financial year, we were seeing numbers as high as turning away 9 out of 10 women and children.
There are 25 crisis units at the Hobart Women's Shelter and it operates 10 other transitional homes. For the few families the shelter can take in, Tasmania's housing crisis means they often can't move out.
We can see that we're going to support less women and children this year because what's happening is that families are staying longer because there are not those exit points for them to leave shelter.
A report by Impact Economics and Policy last year laid bare the dire situation. It found Tasmania had 6 times the national rate of women being turned away from crisis accommodation, and the rate of homelessness among Tasmanian women rose by 50% between 2016 and 2021. The report also estimates that each year nearly 1,000 women return to a violent partner or enter homelessness after experiencing family violence. Janet Saunders again.
It's very frustrating that, you know, we have this great need and we now have evidence that's been completed by Dr. Angela Jackson that shows how desperate we are here in Tasmania for crisis accommodation.
Advocates argue one safe place that could provide relief is lying unused. In another part of the city is a vacant accommodation complex known as Bethlehem House. It was used by St Vincent de Paul to provide supported accommodation for men for half a century. But late last year, that operation moved to a brand new site nearby. Heather Kent is the chief executive of Vinnies in Tasmania.
There is no way that in a housing crisis where too many women need supported accommodation, so not just a basic roof over their heads, there's no way that we want to see that property idle. With 43 beds on site, That is an extra 41,000 nights of accommodation for women who would otherwise be on couches, in tents, living on the streets, or potentially staying in unsafe relationships.
The property includes a heritage building, an extension built in the 1980s, and 18 shipping container pods that act as self-contained units. Tradespeople are already lined up for the estimated six-week project to refurbish the site, funded by philanthropist Bruce Neal, to make it suitable for women's crisis accommodation. If it gets off the ground, it'd operate for 3 years until a bigger redevelopment takes place on the site. But Heather Kent says one vital ingredient is still missing: government funding to employ staff and operate the facility.
The only way that this can move ahead is by gaining a release of funds, and so that's over a three-year period, just under $3.5 million.
Work on the project has been underway since last year, but Tasmania's state election meant the government went into caretaker mode in February, and with vote counting still underway, the funding is still not locked in.
As the weeks, months tick along, we near those cold, harsh times of a Tasmanian winter, and we are so desperate to see this opened up as effective accommodation for women before that time. It's such a golden opportunity. It'd be just such an incredible shame to miss it.
A spokeswoman for the incumbent Tasmanian government says a number of meetings have been held between the proponents of the redevelopment and Homes Tasmania, and further discussions are expected once a new government has been formed.
Alexandra Humphreys. Australian scientists are concerned that rising ocean temperatures could be driving sharks into new areas, putting more strain on them and the ecosystems they live in. The change could have serious impacts on native populations as the animals are forced to adapt to warmer waters. There's also a chance higher water temperatures will raise the likelihood of interactions between sharks and humans in the more urbanised parts of southeast Australia. Anna Pikett reports.
This year has delivered a series of damning environmental reports, all with the same sentiment: act now before it's too late. Analysis from the World Meteorological Organization shows that ocean temperatures have reached their highest level in the 65 years since they've been recorded. With these trends set to continue, scientists are sounding the alarm about how this could impact Australia's vital marine ecosystems.
Sharks, their body temperature is generally the same temperature as the ocean around them.
That's the Australian Marine Conservation Society's shark biologist, Dr. Leonardo Guida.
And so what this means is that you're going to have warmer water or tropical species, say, across northern Australia, move further south into cooler southern waters of Australia. And so you could see, and we are starting to see, tiger sharks and bull sharks moving further south, possibly down as far as the far western parts of Victoria. And it's projected that by 2100, under global warming scenarios, that these tropical species will become more and more of a common feature in our southern waters. And this can shift ecosystem dynamics, so how the ocean works.
He says climate change is having a compounding effect on how Australia's commercial fisheries operate. And this could have a detrimental impact on Australia's threatened and endangered shark and ray species.
So sharks are really important to the ocean ecosystem. Generally, at the top of the food chain, they keep it all in balance and in check. And if we lose too many sharks, we could see the food web become unstable and collapse. And we don't want that, because that ultimately affects seafood that lands on the average Australian person's plate.
Professor Cullen Brown is the head of the fish lab at Macquarie University. He agrees that shark distribution patterns are already starting to shift because of warmer oceans.
The temperatures in and around the coast of southeast Australia at the moment is about 4 degrees above average. And that's only going to get worse as time goes on. In fact, southeast Australia is a global hotspot for rapidly changing ocean temperatures. So it's accelerating, and it's happening faster in that corner of the world than just about anywhere else. So there's going to be this shift in the distribution. And of course, as that distribution overlaps urban areas, then we're going to potentially have more interactions with people.
This could possibly mean more shark attacks.
And it's not because the numbers of sharks are going up, but simply because there's a shift in the distribution. There'll be more sharks in and around urban areas, and quite frankly, there'll be more people in the water.
Dr. Phoebe Maher is a wildlife conservation officer at Taronga Zoo, Sydney. Her team compiles the Australian Shark Incident Database.
We've had 3 incidents this year, one in South Australia, one in New South Wales, and one in Western Australia. this is about on track for number of bites that we will see in, you know, this only 3 months into the new year. And thankfully, we haven't had any fatalities so far.
Dr. Ma agrees the pace of rising ocean temperatures is major cause for concern.
Some animals like sharks may be able to move to find areas that are more suited to their living, but lots of species can't do that. Coral reefs, for example, they can't just pack up and move, and so that's why we see these mass bleaching events. You know, we can't fit the entire world's species into the southern part of the world. So there are going to be impacts about how those ecosystems in the north and the warmer waters, how that will be impacted. You know, if animals are moving out and food webs and food chains start collapsing, we will start seeing impacts in those areas.
Dr. Leonardo Guida says urgent action is needed to stop more species from dying out.
No one can save them but us. They're in our waters, they're in no one else's waters. And we need to take that leadership upon us and really show that it can be done to preserve such an amazing ocean into the future.
That's Dr. Leonardo Guida. He's a shark biologist at the Australian Marine Conservation Society. And that report by Anna Pikett. That's the program for today. Thanks for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. Hope you had a happy Easter. We'll be back tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For decades, we've turned to well-read textbooks to help us understand how our economy will behave. But right now, something strange is happening, and for some economists, it's a bit of a miracle. Today, business editor Ian Verrender on the current economic weirdness. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.